Okay, again, welcome everyone. My name is Molly Marin. I am the webinar coordinator for the New York State RTI Technical Assistance Center. Just a few reminders before we get started today. All upcoming professional development offerings are listed on our webpage at nysrti.org, and we do have several things going on this fall, so I hope you'll check those out. A copy of today's PowerPoint and handouts are available on our webpage. If you go under Current Webinars and then today's webinar title, I also, because of their new webpage, the link is a little longer, so I put it in the chat for you today. If you haven't gotten it and want those hard copies in front of you, you can go out and grab that. During today's presentation, please use the chat box for any questions or comments that you may have. And at the end of today's presentation, we'll post a link to a brief evaluation. If you could please take a few minutes to complete that, we very much appreciate the feedback. You'll also get it via email after the presentation today. We are very pleased to have with us Dr. Catherine Stahl to present our first webinar in our Strand 17 series, Fostering Reading Comprehension for Children in Grades 3 to Grade 6 at Tier 1 or Core Instruction. Today's topic is Avoiding Historical Pendulum Swings in Comprehension Instruction. Dr. Catherine Stahl is a clinical professor of literacy at New York University. She studies the effective instruction of reading in the elementary years. She is committed to improving student achievement and school effectiveness, especially in urban settings. She is currently the director of the NYU Literacy Clinic. For over 25 years, Stahl taught in high-poverty public elementary and middle school classrooms. The questions that she researches stem from those experiences and from current classroom observations. Her research examines reading acquisition and reading comprehension. Dr. Stahl has written 5 books related to literacy instruction. She earned her Ed.D. in reading education from the University of Georgia in 2003. At this time, it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Stahl.
Thank you, Molly. It's great to be here. Welcome, everyone. Let's see, Molly, I'm not seeing the little arrows at the bottom, Molly. Of the screen. Okay, there we are. Okay. So welcome everyone. It's really great to be back with you at the beginning of our new school year, and I hope you've all had a great beginning of the school year, and it's great to see some familiar names up there. So I'm very excited to be doing this topic. This is really my all-time favorite topic. I'm gonna have to watch the time because I just love this topic so much that I can get a little carried away. So those of you who have been with us before know that you can, please feel free to jot questions down in the chat box, and as we go along, I'll try to address those, or if not, I'll definitely address them at the end. Our agenda for today is to look at pendulum swings in comprehension instruction, and also to establish a theoretical framework and some background for, things to be kept in mind and in comprehension instruction. We'll talk about complex text and its implications for comprehension, and then we'll focus on some contemporary comprehension strategy instruction tips. So Molly has told you a little bit about who I am, for those of you who are new to our webinars. Let me also mention that you have a few minutes. If you have not copied these in particular, you can access not only the webinar, but also these articles. And so I'll be covering a lot of information, but everything I am covering, you can go back and revisit in a more leisurely, deeper way with these 2 articles that are available to you that you can copy, and also a sample of one of the activities that I'll be talking about to make it a little more concrete since you can actually see it. But you can actually read these articles later, so any of the material that I'll be talking about today will be covered more thoroughly in those, and one is an article and one is a book chapter, and the other is a sample, an instructional sample. So I would like to know who you are and what roles you have and are involved in your school setting or district setting. What role do you have? So if you would go ahead and complete the poll. Yes, yeah, select what job you have. Oh, I'm so glad to see that we have a speech and language therapist with us today. Everybody knows I call the speech and language therapist the jewel of the school. So I'm so glad. I'm glad we have all of you here with us. But, you know, it is nice to have people who are not necessarily in the classroom, but are major ways of supporting these particular, especially the comprehension. You know, I think speech and language people are often an untapped resource. Okay, and so it looks like we have a lot of interventionists with us, special educator, and a principal and administrator. So this is great. So that'll help frame it, because we also, and I hope that those of you who are here today will share this information with the classroom teachers at your school, because this webinar is actually also very relevant to classroom teachers. And what grade levels do you work with? Based on the group we have, I would expect that most of you are working with almost definitely multiple groups. Okay, yeah, we have one person. Yeah, that's not surprising to me based on our audience today. Okay, so Molly, we can go on to the next. Let's see, I'll go on to the next slide. I think that is that the... Oh, okay. So, you know, I said that our first topic was going to be looking at what some of the current trends are. So if I were to ask you, when you are visiting in classrooms and seeing what other classroom teachers are doing and even what you've been encouraged to do instructionally or what you're reading the most about, sort of like what's hot, what's not, what would you say? You can pick as many as three of these items to say, you know, these are things that really tend to be hot topics right now that I'm seeing a lot of. Pick the three things that you tend to see the most of, that tends to be the most popular thing that you are seeing in third, fourth, and fifth grade. Okay, so I see the close reading tends to be very a trend right now. We see a lot of encouragement with close reading, which I would say, even 5 years ago, we wouldn't even hear the term close reading. And 86% of the people, there were 86% of the people selected close reading as a topic that is really much more of a trend now than it was before. The next one is these turn and talk, you know, as a way to keep kids involved. And then the next most popular one was explicit instruction of comprehension strategies. So I'm glad that you're still seeing that in schools, because I haven't seen much of it lately in the classrooms I'm in. So I am so glad to hear that some people are still doing that. And so we'll be talking a lot more about that. I know that a lot of the schools I'm in are also very actively doing teacher-dependent and text-dependent teacher-generated questions. And even the writing prompts are... find a source of evidence. Make sure you support your answer with evidence. And so I see an awful lot of that and a lot of talk about text-dependent questions and getting kids to write from sources. So that, to me, is also a trend, is what I would have expected. Okay, Molly, we're ready to go to the next page now. Thank you. Now, I would say that what causes these trends and fads are things like politics, policies and regulations, you know, certainly that close reading, because we see in the first anchor standard number one, students will be able to use close reading to identify key ideas and such. So that even that phraseology in the Common Core has resulted, I think, in a lot of close reading. And also the publisher's recommendations for the kinds of practices and that David Coleman and that Pimentel came out with encourages lots of close reading. And also E.D. Hirsch does lots of close reading. And so those politics and policies have been something that have encouraged some of these trends. I think cronyism and opportunists also, they see something like close reading or text-dependent questions, and they build whole sets of materials on those things. Or even like back in the era of reading first, when we had Dibbles become so prevalent, because the people, you know, that you know, that whole cadre of people were very involved in reading first, and so therefore they were using some of the same kinds of assessments for reading first that they themselves were developing, which became very controversial. Also, misuse or overgeneralization of research findings. So we say, for example, yes, we need explicit and systematic phonics instruction. We know that's true. The robust research defends that. But it sort of forgets about the fact that in terms of phonological awareness, they said 20 hours a year or 20 hours was all that children needed. And we see really an abuse of what the research is, or we see it overinterpreted for broader populations. And so we really see research being, you know, that is specific to particular developmental levels or specific to certain populations being overgeneralized and saying, if it's good, a little bit of it's good, more of it's better. And then we also have social climate, you know, as, you know, in terms of where we are socially, things, you know, social trends find their way into classrooms as well. And also, I have to say, ease of implementation. You know, one of the things that we looked at, and I think maybe it's a little less sensitive if we talk about the historical past, but when we looked at whole language, you know, some of those things were a lot easier to implement than when it came to, yes, whole language was talking about children doing things that were, you know, motivating, you know, reading, learning to read through more reading. You know, that's a fairly easy thing, like sustained silent reading. It's very easy to implement that. Something like, however, small group differentiated instruction, not so easy to implement. Lots of work. It's a lot easier to do something for whole group instruction and to do whole group instruction than it is if you're planning four different groups within a day that are differentiated. So also what happens, what tends to be easier to implement, we have found that that tends to become more of a trend. So let's move on to theoretical frames. But what happens is those pendulum swings do have implications in terms of instruction and children's progress. And so even when we talk about comprehension, we have had even an evolution of theory, which is a healthy thing that, you know, as we're learning more and more about these fields, that we should hopefully be improving instruction. So in 1984, we, you know, the schema theory on comprehension, which is the role of, it's not just decoding, you know, reading is not just getting a message from text that you're reading the words, but it's also schema surrounding what prior knowledge children are using or readers are using to propel their comprehension and the individual information and bank of experiences that people have that they actually are interactive with the text and are using their own prior knowledge to inform what they're comprehending. Then, you know, also that is related to, but a little pre, you know, it came before the full development, which was more cognitive, of Walter Kinch's construction integration theory of comprehension, which is, as I said, it's a cognitive theory, but it actually really is very specific in how what readers do is they do bring prior knowledge to a piece of text, they put them together, a pruning process takes place, a merging or integration process takes place, and then what Kinch calls a situation model evolves, which is the combination of that construction and integration process. Now, the common core is very heavily reliant and is saturated in the simple view of reading, which is if you, and this is also if you, if your schools use a lot of the Engage New York materials, and that publisher's recommendations is very heavily influenced by the Simple View, which it means if you take decoding and get kids to decode and become fluent at reading the words, and then on the second pathway, you give them some good prior knowledge and develop oral language, then automatically, if you have those two components, you can read and comprehend. That's the Simple View. And so you will see that those Engage New York materials, whether it's Amplify, whether it's Core Knowledge, those materials are very heavily infiltrated by the Simple View and are adhered to that view. Now, you will hear me, and those of you who know me, know that I believe in, rather than just a two-pathway model, which is what you see in this model, our cognitive model of automatic, fluent automatic word recognition and language comprehension that includes conceptual vocabulary, background knowledge, and knowledge of text structures. We all believe, Mike McKenna, my late husband and myself, we all believe that there's a third pathway, and that's the pathway we're going to be talking a lot about today, which is the strategic processes that children need to bring to reading that are specific to reading. So, for example, what is the purpose of reading? It's not just to read fast. A purpose of reading is really to come away with meaning. Also, within our school context, we often have a specific purpose for reading. If we're following a recipe, it's to have that souffle come out tasty with a nice fluff. If we are reading for a kind of report, then we're looking for information that we can convey to our audience to enrich their knowledge base. If it's to take a reading test, it's to answer those questions and to get to the point of what the test maker is asking us so that we have specific purposes for reading. And then there are those metacognitive strategies, the cognitive strategies for reading. And so we believe that there's that third pathway. Also, what I adhere to is the work that is by Scott Paris on the developmental theory surrounding constrained and unconstrained abilities. And comprehension and vocabulary, which is our focus today, fall into the area of unconstrained skills. And that is very different. It has very different implications for teaching and assessment than these areas of phonics, phonemic awareness, and fluency. They're very different. And this is important because constrained abilities, phonics, phonological awareness, and to a lesser extent, fluency, are fairly linear in development, okay? And with instruction, children develop mastery. These things are easy to assess. So, for example, your phonics skills. You can easily assess whether children know individual letter sounds. It's a constrained set of items. You test the items. They know it. They don't. What they don't know, you teach them. They master it. They reach a ceiling on it. Comprehension and vocabulary are very different. They are multidimensional. They grow incrementally, all right? They are never all or nothing, either vocabulary or comprehension. And they develop across a lifetime, and they are very context dependent. You might know a vocabulary word in one passage, but if you read a different passage around a different topic, you might not know and recognize how that word is used. Say, for example, the word temple. You know, children who are grow up in New York City might have a very different conception of the word temple than a child who grows up and has just moved here from Cambodia or Vietnam. And so those words develop across a lifetime. And so this is important, and it makes comprehension very difficult to assess, even if we're assessing informally when we're asking our children questions in a classroom, because it's never all or nothing. And so this is why those item analysis that people do on tests, you know, are not really the best use of professional development time, because, you know, children might know be able to identify a character trait in a very easy text, a text with a lexile of, say, 600, but they might have a much more difficult time if that text is an information or is a text that's at a 900 level, or is a much more complex text that has a different kind of story structure that has, you know, foreshadowing or thinking back in time to a younger period where a character is changing over time. And so, this makes it very difficult to teach and assess comprehension. Because we have a moving target. It's a moving target. And so when we think about comprehension, it changes by, we have factors which are context. That means the classroom context. Are children doing things in the whole class? Are they doing things independently? Is the teacher carrying the load? Are children working in partners? Are children working by themselves? What is the purpose for reading? It's very easy if you're just looking for information, say to do a report that's on a template, than if you have a much more general purpose for reading, and it's going to influence the outcome. Genre, we know that informational text is more difficult than narrative text. Different genres create different difficulties. And the content, whether that content is familiar or not familiar to children. We certainly still want children to be able to read, because once we get to sixth grade and beyond, most of what we're going to learn is coming from text. So we don't want to excuse or say, we shouldn't expect kids to be able to understand that because they don't have the prior knowledge. No. All of us as adults do a lot of learning from text from which we have minimal prior knowledge. And so that content and how much children know about it is going to influence comprehension. These are all text factors and context factors. Then we have individual student factors that we have to consider. You know, their level of decoding, their level of fluency, their vocabulary bank, their prior knowledge, their metacognition. Do they even recognize that they didn't understand what they just read? Working memory has to do developmentally. You know, younger children are not going to be able to remember as much. That's why we want to stop more intermittently. We don't necessarily want a second grader to read a whole 36-page story before we stop and have a conversation with them. We want to stop intermittently doing some techniques like the directed reading thinking activity. Self-regulation. You know, children need to know, this is a kind of text that I need to read more slowly. This is a kind of text that I need quickly. They need to, you know, be able to be self-regulated learners. I need to sit up nice and tall. I need to really be paying attention when I do this. These all interact to yield comprehension thresholds. There's also a level of threshold required in decoding and fluency to read certain things, but they also yield comprehension thresholds as they work together like gears. Now, if you look on page 2, if you have the article, the comprehension strategy article, not your father's Oldsmobile, on page 2, there is a model similar to this. But this is a model that basically explains that we have context, which includes engaging content, text, and scaffolding and discourse. All right. When we're doing comprehension instruction, we want to do it with content that is worth reading about. It helps also in the grades 3 through 6 if we're all reading and writing about a common topic and that our teacher is building our knowledge and building excitement about that topic. So that's why doing this in units, thematic units, social studies units, science units, literary units is a much more effective way to teach comprehension than just having us read random topics here and there. Having a range of text is important, both in difficulty, topic, and genre. And, of course, having the continuum of scaffolding is important, and talk, lots of talk in comprehension instruction is imperative. That's the other reason, and I have this word discourse here, because also that's the other reason we want to teach our comprehension within our thematic units, because the way we talk and build knowledge in science, even in grade 3, is different than the way we talk and read and write about historical documents. It's different how we read, how we write, how we talk about literary text is different. And so therefore, we want to give children explicit practice in each of those discourses because it's intimately connected with our learning. This second round has what our activities, our instructional activities need to look like to support the reader. We need to have comprehension strategy and self-regulation instruction. We need to have questioning, rich questioning, created by both teachers and children, and both teacher and student-led discussions. We need to have vocabulary development and expansion, and we need to have writing. These two middle areas here, the writing and discussion, are so important because the only two ways that we know whether children or readers are comprehending is by what they say about what they've read and what they've written. So we cannot separate comprehension instruction from those two areas, and we will be talking in depth about those in our webinar number 3. Today, our focus will be on comprehension strategies and regulation. And so, Molly, if you can just briefly show for a minute that these are also in the article that you will be reading. They're organized a little different way, just in a cycle, but you see the exact same components. You also see what the National Reading Panel also added is essential, is that collaborative learning. I sort of built that into scaffolding and discourse, and then graphic organizers, which also are there to support the strategy instruction. And this is page 2 of your article that you have. So, Molly, we can go to the next page now. Okay. Our Common Core standards really emphasize, the Common Core learning standards really do focus on high-level comprehension and the expression of that comprehension all the way from K through 12, really. And, you know, we're going to have a whole different webinar series on K-2 because comprehension is at the forefront even in those primary grades. Now, you intermediate grade teachers should probably be celebrating that because it will really, it's not just that, oh, now that we're in third grade that we can start teaching comprehension. You know, hopefully you'll see a change that there's a lot more comprehension instruction going on in K-1 and 2 now. Also, comprehension must be integrated with writing and disciplinary content. It cannot be, we can no longer teach reading in silos. Reading cannot be the curriculum bully. And finally, in relationship to the Common Core, I know there's been a lot of talk and a lot of, you know, stuff coming out of the New York State DOE, oh, that we're taking a look at the standards and we're changing the standards. I'm going to tell you, in 1976, 40 years ago, when I started teaching, I was teaching those anchor standards. They may not have been called Common Core anchor standards, but I was teaching anchor standards in 1976. Those anchor standards are based on long-standing research. I don't care what kind of changes, what kind of pendulum swings are going on, those anchor standards may have a different name. They're not changing. We still need to be teaching those same 9 anchor standards. And now, certainly, the grade level standards were devised to, based on tradition, in an attempt to sensibly chunk the standards in a sensible way into smaller bites. But remember, comprehension is unconstrained. You can't really parse it out like you can phonics skills and say, okay, now we're going to teach the short vowel, compare short A and short O. You can't do that. You can't do it with comprehension. You can't just take a piece of chunk of it and say, okay, now we're just going to teach this. That's what makes comprehension instruction difficult to teach because it's unconstrained. You can't make it into a chunk. And the anchor standards are your more reliable gauge. You do need to have these 6 shifts. And, you know, these are really the non-negotiables in the Common Core. And I like to put the knowledge in the disciplines first of the 6 shifts because I know that they've said that this is more highly emphasized above grade 6, but the reality is the balance of your narrative and informational text is an effect of the knowledge and the disciplines. We want kids, our kids, I don't care if you're a pre-K teacher, you're wanting kids to use reading, writing, and talking to help them build knowledge about the world. That's what it's all about. And so if we're wanting our kids to use reading, writing, and talking to build knowledge about the world, the effect of that is that you're using both narrative and informational text. It's not that you use narrative and informational text and say, oh, I'm going to have 50% of this and 50% of this in some unnatural silo way. It's that you're building knowledge, and as a result, you need to pull in a good balance of text, and you're using rich vocabulary, and you're asking kids to build their knowledge based on the text they're reading, and then they're writing about it, and they're communicating it with others. And so that's how that all sort of fits in together organically, if you're using it in an organic way to build knowledge. Now, one of the most controversial aspects of the Common Core is the complex text. Because the texts that are recommended, if we look at the Lexile levels, often teachers say, but those texts are too hard for my students. And in fact, when I give my, whether I'm using a computer-based text to get a Lexile for my kids, or whether I'm using the Fountas and Pinnell kit, when I do that assessment, those texts at those levels that the Common Core is telling me to use, those are frustration level for my kids. Well, we need to talk about this because instructional levels are malleable, and they are contingent upon the amount of instruction provided. This next bullet is really important. O'Connor, and many of you are reading interventionists. This is huge for you folks. O'Connor did research that determined, she was a special ed teacher, as a matter of fact, and she determined that struggling readers in grades 3 through 5 performed equally well at the end of the year on all their general reading post-tests, regardless of whether in their intervention she had two different groups. She had several groups of kids that she was researching, and those kids, when they were with their interventionist, they were reading text at their instructional level. She had several other groups of kids in grades 3 through 5 that were reading just grade level text in their intervention settings and in their special ed settings. And guess what? It didn't matter. They both achieved equally well. There was a caveat, as long as they were reading 55 words a minute. Okay, so, but we do know, and Kinch's work proves this, Walter Kinch, Paula Schwanenflugel, her work with second and third graders, and even some of the work that I've done, is that we know that complex text has a positive effect on fluency, including prosody and comprehension. If children have to stretch a little bit, they tend to stay more engaged, and they become interactive with the text. And so we know that we want children to make more progress if the text is at the top of their zone of proximal development, is somewhat of a stretch text. Now, of course, you have to monitor for how these difficult texts are taught and strive for accessibility, not spoon feeding. You do not want to be reading all the text to the kids. You want their eyes on text and doing some things like choral reading, partner reading, and different kinds of methods like that that make the text accessible to them. And because remember the function, and our function for these texts is comprehension. We're not teaching decoding with these texts, we're teaching thinking. And that's the thing, is if you're going to ask kids to think about text, it has to be complex enough to have something to think about. And those are the texts that also help children develop richer vocabularies. So what we want to keep in mind is the gradual release of responsibility with these complex texts. And, you know, Pearson and Gallagher invented the gradual release of responsibility and put it into a diagram like this, and Duke and Pearson did more with it. And so we have explicit instruction, then we have modeling, where the teacher is still carrying most of the load. We have modeling by the teacher. We have modeling by children. Then we have guided practice. We still haven't asked the kids to do anything by themselves yet. And then we have partner work. We have small group work that's student-led. We still haven't asked the kids to do anything by themselves yet. And then finally, the student assumes the responsibility. And so that means that this comprehension is occurring during teacher read-alouds. That's where, and if we're talking specifically about comprehension strategies, everybody needs those strategies. So we introduce it during a teacher read-aloud when we have the whole group. Then we model it when we're doing shared reading. Then we get our kids in small groups and see if they can apply it with text at their level. And we also do it during content area instruction. So we remember that our function is comprehension and vocabulary development during the teacher read aloud and during the shared reading and shared writing when we're doing text-based writing. So we want a more complex text in these aspects, in these times of our day. And so we're using the more difficult text here that are those lexiles in the recommended Common Core levels. Then when we get to our small, differentiated, small reading groups, that is where children are reading their instructional level text. And so it might look something like this. And for those of you who have done some of the workshops with me before, you've seen this chart before. So that this is, these are the levels that children might be likely, and that Founis and Pinnell recommend in guided reading, that they are reading, okay? In third grade, M through P during the year. In fourth grade, P through S. But you notice those lexiles, if we use lexile equivalency charts, those will not get kids where they need to be for taking the Common Core test. If you're relaxing and saying, this kid is at a level P, I can breathe, he's reached the benchmark level. Well, he may have reached the benchmark level, but he is not going to be able to get a 4 probably on the ELA test, because these are the lexile levels that the ELA test is going up to. And so what you really want is still exposing to kids at those levels in shared reading and in the teacher read aloud. Because remember, comprehension is never all or nothing. Children can be functional at those levels with reading support and accessibility. Even kids in special ed must be exposed to and supported in reading those complex texts. And really, you can feel comfortable using those F&P levels from kindergarten through grade 2, but all of you in grades 3 through 6 have to be shifting to lexiles. Lexiles are going to provide a finer comprehension gradient, even though you're using a likely comfort zone using that range, all right? Comprehension is unconstrained. You're not going to get it to a pinpoint. Lexiles are more theoretically based on a quantitative measuring stick of features that contribute to comprehension, which is sentence length and word frequency. And these texts do require instruction. All right, you really do need to have your sustained strategy instruction with these texts. And by doing that, you will be building strong readers. So now we're really going to focus in on what should strategy instruction look like? What should strategy instruction look like? I'd like you to take a minute to jot down on your presenter, on your handout, what are the reading strategies I'm going to be talking about today, do you think? When I say reading strategies, what strategies am I talking about? Take a minute to write them down on your, if you have your, if you have your handout there, write them on your handout or write them on a scrap piece of paper. And you can even chat, you can even type them in for me. I'd love to see them typed in, what you, because I want to know what your prior knowledge is in terms of what you are considering the strategies. Everybody can type in one strategy. That would be great. Keep you awake this afternoon in case you didn't have your cup of coffee before you came after your full day of school. So I want to make sure you stay awake with me. Thank you, Mary. Great. We have monitoring. Set a purpose. Christine is typing. Thinking about reading. How about a couple more? How about if I give you a clue? What is the most overused and abused comprehension strategy? Oh, Mary, you have the asking questions is the hardest one. What's the easiest one and most abused and overtaught? Retelling is important. Okay, let's look at what the research says are the important strategies to teach. Tapping prior knowledge. Now, you literacy specialists, I know that you know what you see most often in classrooms. Here is the predicting is the number one most overtaught and abused comprehension strategy. Organizing idea and text structures. Very important and also very difficult to teach. Visualizing, questioning, both how to answer questions and how to generate good questions. Monitoring, summarizing or taking stock, and evaluating. I am so glad nobody said text-to-text connections. Great group. This is a very advanced group I have. And also the National Reading Panel. This was always confusing to me. And they're like, why did they put cooperative learning and graphic organizers there? You know, these are not really cognitive strategies like the other ones are. But these are more, this cooperative learning is a teaching context. And yes, we want to use a lot of it in comprehension instruction. And graphic organizers are also a teaching strategy that have a good research base and are useful tools for teaching things such as text structure and comprehension and summarization. Now, strategy, this is a biggie. This is a biggie. Strategy instruction should teach declarative knowledge, procedural knowledge, and conditional knowledge. You might want to take notes on this. Declarative knowledge, you actually explicitly tell the kids, here is what we're learning today. We are going to learn how to make a prediction. And, a prediction is not a wild guess, but it is what you expect that you are going to be reading about based on evidence. Procedural knowledge, well, I'm going to jump down to conditional knowledge. Conditional knowledge, we also tell the students explicitly, why do we use this? We use prediction to help us remember what we've read and also to make sense of what we've read. When do we use the strategy and when don't we use the strategy? We can use the strategy of prediction with both narrative text and informational text. We can really use it. We use it at the beginning of reading, and we use it throughout the reading. When we stop and take stock, then we predict what we're going to be continuing to read. So we don't just do it in the beginning of the book. We don't just do it for a picture walk. We do it throughout reading. We also do not do predictions if we've already read the story, because that's not a prediction. procedural knowledge. We teach the kids the actual steps for how we do something. If we're making a prediction, we use our prior knowledge. We use story structure. If we're reading a story, we use text structure and the headings. That's why that's why informational texts have headings. They're signaling what we're going to be reading about. That's what cues our prediction. And we actually teach them how to do it. We always use that gradual release of responsibility. We always start teaching a strategy with the direct explanation. We model it in shared reading. We are modeling with kids how to do it. And then we present opportunities for them to do it out loud publicly, not just in a turn and talk, folks. Because when those kids are turning and talking, you don't know what they're saying. So we want to have that modeling happening publicly. We want kids doing it out loud, and there might be a couple turn and talks, but we also want to make sure then we bring it back and have it public in front of the class. We want to have guided practice. We want it done in small reading groups. I know that in some locations, a lot of people don't do small reading groups. They say, we don't do guided reading. I'm not talking about Faunus and Pinnell reading. In grades 3, 4, and 5, you still want to have small groups of instruction, and the kids are probably not reading at the table. But when you come back to the table, that's where they're doing some guided practice of these strategies, and you're seeing if they can summarize what they read at a station before they came to the table. If they can actually generate some good questions themselves about what they've read. And so then independently, the application of it. The gradual release of responsibility. I was working with Barbara Taylor and David Pearson, and we did a study of the gradual release of responsibility and of strategies. And here is what we found in a lot of our observations. We saw that, okay, and there are many ways to release responsibility and provide more support with kids. Not only is it a gradual release of responsibility and kinds of scaffolding by support from others, but even the kind of text or vehicles for teaching it are levels of support. From experiences to videos to wordless picture books to teacher read-alouds to shared reading to small guided reading groups. And we saw that teachers did a lot of, you know, they might have taught it whole class. In these schools, a lot of them were doing the teaching in small groups and then going directly to have kids doing it by themselves. There were lots of ways they could have backed up when kids had trouble, and all these boxes were left empty. So when children are having trouble and say, oh, let's say they get to the end, oh, they didn't know how to do it, they weren't successful writing a summary, they weren't successful in generating thick, juicy questions, their questions were trivial, well, let's talk about some of these other ways that we can provide additional scaffolding. All right, open-ended questions, the best ways. Questioning is the hardest thing for children to learn how to do well. And so what the best way to teach both teachers and children to ask good questions is to provide question stems. We want initiating questions, and then we want teachers to be asking follow-up questions to take the thinking to a higher level. We also want to be asking questions that provoke that kind of evaluative thinking and critical literacy. Whose opinion is absent from the text? Whose opinion is this? An author wrote this. Somebody wrote this. What are they trying to accomplish with this text? Who did the author expect to read this text? And how could we rewrite this text to convey a different representation? Now, if we want, and this should be test prep, in grades 3 through 6, I would say by October, every teacher in grades 3, 4, and 5 should be teaching question-answer relationships, because this is how children, this is great ELA test prep. that is worth the time and is profitable and has wide transfer. Question answer relationships, you know, not all questions answers can be found in the text. Some are right there, some are think and search, some are author and me, and some are in my head. In the ELA test, you're probably going to find mostly these two kinds of questions. I'll tell you what, in the year 2016, you're not going to find right there questions on an ELA test like you would in 1976. And you're not going to find any in my head questions. It's all in this category. Teaching kids how to identify the kinds of questions they're being asked and how to construct an answer for those questions is worth teaching. Also, if you're wanting to teach teachers sometimes, many of you are in a position to be working with teachers. And so we want to use STEMS to help get kids to ask good questions, and we also want to get teachers to ask good questions. QAR is not the best strategy for teaching kids how to generate their own questions. It's using STEMS, and there's a really good article in The Reading Teacher in 2004 that you can reference. And here are some additional question STEMS that teachers should, if you're a literacy interventionist or if you are a principal or assistant principal, you should, and one of the things, you can do this as an interventionist. You can say, you know, it would really help my children that are in your class to, if you had a poster, and maybe even making the poster for the teachers that you work with, make these posters for their classrooms so that both they and the children can use these to enhance their level of question generation. And here is an example of what teachers put on there that will help their children do, that we're doing reciprocal teaching, actually, all right? Yeah, so this is sort of out of place, this slide. Prediction, I think the directed reading thinking activity is a technique that once you've explicitly taught prediction, this is an excellent way to practice it, both in read aloud and in children reading text in the small group. Segmenting the text, kids make a prediction and justify it, and then after reading, they have to verify whether, you know, a section, did this happen or not, and then take stock. This is where you're also, as we said, you know, children need intermediate stopping points, especially in third grade. Let's stop. Let's take stock. Let's make sure you don't have any misunderstandings. Was there vocabulary that was confusing? Were there ideas that were confusing? And then begin the cycle for the next section of text. What do you think is going to happen next? Visual cues. Using think alouds, children need to know, and this needs to be explicit for kids. When you're reading, make a movie in your mind. You and I know this. But it needs to be explicitly taught to kids. And before, if you're given the ELA test, before the teacher ever passes out the test, a simple prompt to kids. Remember, when you're reading the passages, make a movie in your mind. That raises test scores, research has found. That's not breaking the rules. That's not cheating. You haven't given the test booklets out yet. All right? And to remind kids to do that before reading. Using graphic organizers. I would urge a caution with this. I think too often graphic organizers are given out and it's not really tied to the text and the kids don't know why they're even using them. So I think we want to use caution and make sure that the graphic organizers we're using, that children are understanding how it fits with that text structure, and that by fifth grade, if you're doing this in first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, I would think that by fifth grade, the kids themselves are developing their own graphic organizers. And using videos to support strategy instruction. You know, time is of the element for kids, and you really want to, you know, use visual. One picture is worth a thousand words. You can get a lot of strategy instruction done and have kids engage and ask the same kinds of questions that you do with text with a video. Organizing ideas is very important. There we go again with the graphic organizers, story maps, those expository structures. I can't say enough about how important they are for comprehension, actually teaching them explicitly. And again, this is where your thematic units come in. If you're teaching 20 different kinds of text and every day a different kind of text, then you're not really able to have sustained lessons on a kind of text structure, read it in the read aloud, read it in the shared reading, get kids to read that text structure in the books at their level, and then that's what they're also writing. They're writing text at that level. Summarization. Summarization. If I asked you to what are the keys to how do you write a summary, is this what you would have come up with? Because this is how we write summaries, but we do it so tacitly. So there is a strategy. Molly, could you pull this up? There's a strategy called GIST that really is excellent at helping kids to develop summaries. And so in GIST, students begin creating summaries for sentences using 15, 25, the GIST strategy has them use 15 words, and you put 15 spaces. You start out by saying to the kids, okay, here are two sentences. Let's summarize those two sentences together in these 15 spaces, and you do it yourself on chart paper, and the children, you're walking the kids through it. Then you go, okay, now here are three sentences, the same three sentences. Now let's summarize that to 15 words. Now, you could do this with 25 words, or the Fuchs in their PALS, they do it with just 10 spaces. But gradually, you increase the amount of text being summarized, and you do it as a whole class procedure first, gradual release of responsibility. Then you do it in small groups, and finally, you would ask the kid to do it independently. And I have given you a GIST paper that shows you an example, a GIST handout of how to do that. And you actually make the blanks. You make spaces, like three lines with five spaces, three lines with five spaces, and the children put a word on each space.
My apologies, Kay. I lost connection for a minute there.
Oh, sorry.
Do you still need this?
Not really. The teachers all have it, and I think it'll just make more sense when they actually look at it. I'm so glad I was able to find that example.
Okay.
So you can take that off. Now, remember, the goal of all of this, though, folks, the goal of all of this is flexibly using the strategies to make sense of text, to overcome the meaning-making hurdles of what they're reading. The goal is not to use the strategy. It's sort of like that close reading. You know, with close reading, so often it's like they're doing it, you know, it's like an end in itself. No, the goal is not to use the strategy. The goal is to flexibly use strategies on an as-needed basis spontaneously and flexibly when you come to a hard bit so that you really know, hey, I didn't understand this. I'd better go back, I'd better reread, I'd better take stock. Let me take stock again back here, and now read the next sentence, take stock, and blend that in and integrate that with what I just read, and now read another sentence, let me take stock again. And so you're really wanting to have children use all the strategies flexibly. You want to teach singly, but move toward authentic integration of multiple strategies. And I think that the DRTA is a wonderful starting place for teachers who don't have experience doing this. So they have prediction, and basically you're doing prediction and taking stock. All right. And you might even do some, what picture did you make in your mind as you were reading, you know, during that intermittent stopping point? Then move on to something like reciprocal teaching, which is still fairly routinized, okay? Still fairly routinized. In reciprocal teaching, which has a very strong research base, children are doing four strategies: clarifying, summarizing, questioning, and predicting. Now, remember, this is not roles. Kids are not taking roles. It's that each student takes turns being the teacher and leading the discussion about a section of text that they just read silently or chorally together in a little group of, say, four or five kids. And then the child A leads the discussion. Was there anything anybody didn't understand? My summary of this is such and such. Does anybody think anything I said was not important enough to go in a summary, or is there anything I omitted that should be in the summary? And then they ask a question, a big idea question about what the group just read, and then the child makes a prediction for the next section of text. So, and then student B, after they read the next section of text, then student B leads the discussion. So you have pre-taught all these skills individually. This has a very robust research base from first grade through college. In grades 3, 4, and 5, especially with informational text, you should be walking in classrooms and seeing this happening. And also, this is not a bad strategy to use. It was actually developed in an intervention setting. That's where it was developed. So it's not a bad strategy to also use in intervention settings. Something similar to reciprocal, and let me just say, with all of these, you want to give the kids little cheat sheets. Like, here is a cheat sheet that a teacher had on as a chart: predict, clarify, question, summarize. Some teachers make these cheat sheets as charts. Sometimes they make them as bookmarks, but they're posted or available to kids. So that you have not only the teacher verbalization as a scaffold, but another scaffold along the journey, along the continuum of releasing responsibility, is these kinds of cheat sheets. Similar and based on reciprocal teaching is the collaborative strategic reading. And I hope that some of you will be attending the workshops with Allison Boardman, who is actually doing a 2-day thorough workshop on collaborative strategic reading. And so this is actually based on reciprocal teaching. Klingner and Vaughn started, doing reciprocal teaching with the children they worked with in special education settings and also English language learner settings. And so then they sort of tweaked and massaged reciprocal teaching also, and did it in a before reading, during reading, and after reading model that has preview the text, where you activate prior knowledge and make purposeful predictions. The kids were monitoring whether they were clicking or clunking as they read, and they learned how to adjust when they were clunking. What do I do? And there might have been a cheat sheet for that. And I think Allison Boardman shows you a nice cheat sheet for that for kids to have. And then they retell and identify the key ideas in getting the gist. And then after reading, there's a wrap-up where, again, you question, develop some high-level questions, and summarize everything that you've read. And so Allison Boardman will be doing some two-day workshops that are sponsored by the TAC. And also a webinar. She'll be doing a follow-up webinar so that you can actually learn how, and the teachers in your school can learn how to do this with their students very thoroughly. Here is another kind of cheat sheet posters. These are some posters that I had in my classroom as cheat sheets for the strategies. And again, the before reading. What strategies are you using before reading? Set purposes, get ready to read. Predict, during reading, predict and confirm, picture it in my mind, decide, this pruning process, what's important, what do I not have to remember, because I can't remember everything. The unimportant things I should not be remembering. I should be, just trying to keep the key ideas in my mind, and monitoring, did what I read make sense, look right, and sound right. Problem solving. What do I do in monitoring if I have a problem? What's not clear? And then after reading, how do I communicate this with others? Because it's that communicate. What do I want to talk to others about? What do I need to write about to help my comprehension and to share it? And then doing this thematically, doing this, you know, in my teaching, we began the year with family, friends, and neighbors. During that unit, I taught visualizing and predicting. I hit it hard. During my nature unit with informational text, I hit ideational prominence and text structure of declarative text. I hit it hard. I hit hard prior knowledge and evaluation during the Native American text, and so on. And so I really am using these strategies in a deliberate way to help my kids. Gee, with the text I'm going to be reading, what are the hurdles they encounter when they're reading these texts? And what strategies are going to help them that I can really hit hard in this 2 or 3 weeks? So we will be meeting again next week. I hope you all will be with me next week on October 5th. I want you to be typing in some questions and some things you've been thinking about during this presentation. But I'm going to give you some homework for next week. And you have the article, Contemporary Comprehension Strategies, Not Your Father's Automobile. So there is on page 237 to 238, there are some questions for reflection about your own, about you personally. How do you teach these comprehension strategies to the children you are responsible for? And write out the answers. Because when we write out the answers, don't just glance at it and think about it. It's the writing it that helps us process it more deeply ourselves. And so write out your answers to those questions. In your instruction, between now and next week, business as usual. But be aware and be considering what 2 comprehension strategies in the reading that your students are going to be doing in October. And let's say if you're a reading interventionist, maybe look at what literary units, science units, social studies units, your students in their classrooms, what units are upcoming units of instruction? And what are the 2 comprehension strategies that might be likely to help your students overcome meaning-making hurdles in texts that they are going to be seeing in the month of October? And just be thinking about it. Just increase your awareness of it. And bring your thoughts and your reflections back with us on October 5th so we can open with that as some discussion. So I would like you, are there questions, concerns, things you would like feedback on related to anything in our presentation today? Our presentation next week will focus on talking a little more about this after you've had time to do your personal reflections. We'll start with that, and then we'll zoom in on that close reading that has become such a trend in classrooms today. Comments, questions, input about your own comprehension strategy instruction or trends you're seeing in your classrooms that you're working with or in your schools? Oh, good. I'm glad to see some feedback coming in.
And while people are typing, I'm just going to post a link to the evaluation.
Oh, thank you, Molly. Yes, I love hearing your thoughts. Oh, good, Catherine, and I'm hoping you'll also join us for the K2. The K2, you know, I love comprehension overall. K2 comprehension is my baby. I love comprehension in kindergarten through second grade. So I hope you'll also join us for that one. Oh, good. Yes, make a move. You know, Linda Gambrell did a research study on teaching visualization, and then she found that the kids who had that little prompt actually did higher. I mean, and you will find, particularly in the special ed classroom, special ed and some of you interventionists, some kids will not. I would not have believed this if I hadn't been sitting there. I was sitting in a room when a teacher, this was general ed, a teacher was teaching visualization. And you know what? A kid raised his hand, third grade, and said, Miss Marks, or I forget what her name was, Miss Marks, but it was like, her name was Jeannie. Well, Miss Jeannie, when I try to make a movie in my mind, it's all dark in there. And so this teacher really had to step it back in teaching how to kids to make a movie in their mind. So it's so important, so important. So, So reciprocal teaching, Laura. So you're doing some reciprocal teaching where you're explicitly teaching each strategy first, using that declarative, conditional, and procedural. And I believe in the article, I could be wrong about this, but I do think in that comprehension article, I think there's actually a script in there for how to teach either prediction or visualization. I know that in my book, Comprehension K-2, I know we have it for visualization. But I think there's actually a script in that article, in that chapter, for how to teach comprehension in a declarative, conditional way. Because I like that you're talking more intervention strategies and not just trying to fix it for the test. Yeah. Well, and I do think... Oh, he has scripts there too, okay, on how to do descriptive, conditional, and procedural knowledge. That's great. And it's on, so that's on Intervention Central. Laura, thank you for sharing that with us. Thank you for sharing that with us so much. Well, yeah, and Catherine, you know, the comments about Engage New York. I mean, I think it is important. See, and that's why theories are important, and not that one theory is right or wrong. But when we are using people's materials, it's important to know what theory they adhere to. And so that's why I know some people, those of you who have been with me for multiple sessions, may go, oh, here she is pulling out that cognitive model again. Well, one of the reasons I pull that cognitive model out frequently, because I want you all to know where I'm coming from. And so that way you may disagree with that cognitive model and say, oh, well, I disagree with that, so... But I understand that what she's saying is based on that. So, you know, I don't necessarily agree with a simple view. And so I want you to know, here's the model that I'm sort of coming from in everything I'm sharing with you. And so it's important for you to know that. But those modules do have lots of good resources. But as with any teaching materials, you do need to be selective and use your learning theory. Oh, and I'm so glad that you can share these, Christine. I hope some of you others will also share these either explicitly with the teachers you work with or using little nudging devices like, you know, creating the poster for those kids I love, because we can all learn, I think, so much from each other. So I think our time is just about up. Is that right, Molly?
Yes.
Yeah. And so please, I love your comments and, you know, your responses to how our first webinar has gone. And, you know, even if you, in your comments, you know, put some comments about you know, oh, in the future, Dr. Stahl, or in the future, Kay, if you could, you know, can you include some stuff about this? You know, this is something my school is struggling with. And either in webinar 2 or webinar 3, can you include X, Y, and Z? And I'll be sure to, you know, fit that in wherever possible. So I look forward to seeing you next week, and I hope you'll enjoy the two readings, the chapter on comprehension strategies, and also Scott Paris wrote the article on constrained and unconstrained skills, but I wrote a little Cliff Notes version on that New Visions. That New Visions is his work in sort of a Cliff Notes version for people who may not have time to read Reading Research Quarterly. So it's like the teacher. Okay, thanks, and I'll see you all next week.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stahl. Some wonderful information, and have a good night, everybody. Okay,
thank
if you want
Molly.
To stay on for a minute,
that'd
be great.
Molly. Thank you. I will stay on.